Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the New Books Network. This is Emily Allen, your host for this episode. Today, I'm talking with Christopher Reale, author of Music and Mystique in Messel Shoals, published by the University of Illinois Press in 2022. A little bit more about the book. The forceful music that rolled out of Messel Shoals in the 1960s and 1970s shaped hits by everyone from Wilson Pickett and Aretha Franklin to the Rolling Stones and Paul Simon. So Christopher M. Reale's in-depth look at the fabled musical hotbed examines the events and factors that gave the Messel Shoals sound such a potent cultural power. Many artists trekked to famed studios and Messel Shoals sound in search of the sound of authentic Southern Black music, and at times expressed shock at the mostly white studio musicians waiting to play it for them. Others hoped to draw on the hit-making production process that defined the scene. Reale also chronicles the overlooked history of Messel Shoals' impact on country music and describes the recent region's recent transformation into a tourism destination. So multifaceted and informed, Music and Mystique in Messel Shoals reveals the people, places, and events behind one of the most legendary recording scenes in American history. And a little bit more about our speaker today. Christopher Reale is an assistant professor of music at Ramapo College of New Jersey. So thank you, Chris, for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Awesome. So before we discuss the book, can you tell us a little bit more about you?
Sure. I've been a musician for my entire life, and I've had a multiple career before I went into academia. I've been a musician. I used to work for David Gray and Chris Whitley, as a guitar technician and tour manager for Chris. And then I worked for David Gray during his ascension, with the White Ladder, which is now celebrating its 22nd year of history. But, and then I taught middle school band, and then I eventually, while teaching musical band, I was like, this is great. I love teaching music, but I'd like to have maybe deep in-depth conversations. Some faculty members while I was pursuing my master's degree in education, they were encouraged me to seek to go off to get a PhD, and so I eventually did, and I went to UNC Chapel Hill, and lived in the South for a while, and then eventually got lucky enough to get a tenure track job at a college in New Jersey, which is where I am now, and I teach both music history and music industry classes.
Awesome. And within that journey, how did you actually start this project about Messel Shoals?
It started when I was a kid. I've been playing in bands my whole life, and we always played music that was recorded in Messel Shoals, although I didn't know that at the time. And like many people, I probably first heard of Messel Shoals through Lynyrd Skynyrd's song Sweet Home Alabama, where they say Messel Shoals has got the Swampers, but like pretty much everybody in the country, I had no idea what that meant. And it's funny, David Hood, who's the bass player for the Swampers, or known as the Messel Shoals Rhythm Section, he once told me, He's like, yeah, when that song came out, oh, you guys are going to be famous. And David said, no one knows what that means. It was an inside joke. So anyway, so I've been playing the music for a long time. And then when I got to Chapel Hill, my first semester there, I was in a seminar and we were asked to do a research project based on our archival project based at the Southern Folklife Collection, which is this massive archive at UNC that they all things Southern, from like, you know, cooking, food, everything. And so they had a small collection from Jerry Wexler, who was the legendary producer. And in it, there was Wexler had a type manuscript article that was published in Billboard in 1969. And so that became the basis of this paper. And then I realized, hey, there's not much on Muscle Shoals out there other than basically a chapter in a book or two. And then I was stupefied considering how much music had been recorded there. And that literally opened the doors to the entire project. And just by serendipity, one of my classmates had befriended somebody else, and somebody who lived in Chapel Hill, somebody who lived in Durham, and his dad, Willie McFarlane, happened to be, he was a member of the Muscle Shoals rhythm section in the 90s. And so Will was my first interview. He used to live in Durham, and then Will helped me get in touch with Jimmy Johnson, and all these other doors opened through that. So some of it was just dumb luck, and some of it was because I had to write this paper. So.
Awesome. And so you kind of found this wealth of information that fed into the book. And like you said, a lot of people probably recognize this from the Skynyrd song, but also that documentary that came out, right, like a few years ago. So where do you see your book fitting within this? Like, what do you think people who have seen the documentary might learn from your book that they don't know otherwise?
In the Small World Department, so when my first trip down to the Shoals, which was the summer of 2011, they were making the movie at that time. And I did not meet those guys, but a bunch of my contacts were like, oh, hey, they're making a movie, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so then, yeah, the movie comes out in 2014, I guess it was. And in many ways, the movie is the antagonist of the book, because there's a lot of things in the movie that's just wrong. And again, it's a massive story, and there's no way to tell it, and there's no way to tell that much history in the 2-hour movie. And I totally understand that. But there are some things that are just actually that are factually inaccurate. So the one thing I talk about a little bit in the book is that Rick Hall, it portrays Rick Hall as this great man theory, that it was all him. And of course, you know, to make a compelling documentary, you need to have a strong lead character. And so Rick Hall was certainly that person. And it's funny, I never talked to Rick Hall ever. Like, they would never let me near him, which is kind of funny. So where in actuality, there was a lot of people who were very involved in the story. And I remember I saw a screening of the movie somewhere when I lived in North Carolina, and Dan Penn was there. And Dan Penn said, oh, I like the movie, but I'm really upset that there's a bunch of people that they left out, such as James Joyner. So James Joyner, who I talk about in the book, he's basically he's the guy that said, hey, we should have a music industry here. And he started this whole thing. And he's left out of the movie. And so I think one of the things that I try to do in the book is that if this is the only book that's ever written on the scene, which I doubt it will be, I want to get as many names in there as possible, because it is such a diverse network of people. Of course, the Rick Halls and the Swampers are significant to the story, but they're only a portion of the story. And so, you know, probably the most significant thing that if you watch the movie and then read the book, the movie doesn't even talk about the country music scene at all. It just completely left out, because so many people are enamored with the soul music section. Again, and it's all part of the Muscle Shoals mystique. The movie feeds right into the Muscle Shoals mystique, my idea of the Muscle Shoals mystique, which I was like, oh, that's great. It just reinforces my theory. So thank you, Stephen Badger, and whoever made the movie, and Greg Calmier for making the movie. So.
Yeah. And speaking of that theory, we can kind of unpack that a little bit further, right? Like, you kind of complicate a lot of those things that you're just talking about, like the way these Northern executives like package the South and all this, all those different people that you said were involved. So can you talk a little bit about how this mystique, you know, builds all this hype up, right, around, you know, Muscle Shoals and music?
Yeah. So, you know, the music industry is a business. And every business relies on your last hit, especially the music industry. So people like Wexler and others, and it obviously goes way back into even into the Tin Pan Alley era, as you know, as my research and people who've other done other research around that Tin Pan Alley era. This has been a long standing thing. Like, things are better in the South. I mean, this again, there's been this, again, as I said, long-standing love affair with the South as this rural agrarian paradise. I mean, and we'll put chattel slavery over here, but we'll leave it out for a second. People, they forget about that. And so Wexler was able to capitalize on that. Part of that is it was his own upbringing. He's from the North, and he was enamored with music by Black musicians, you know, Louis Armstrong, a lot of early ragtime and jazz players. And then he gets into this position of power, and he's able to actually influence the direction of popular music. And he goes down to the South, and he realizes that these incredibly talented musicians who aren't union members, who are willing to work for less money, and he takes advantage of them. Again, there's no doubt that there was a love affair. They loved each other. There was a deep respect on both sides. Wexler had a respect for the musicians. The musicians had a respect for Wexler and everything he did. And there were definitely a kinship. And I think, you know, Wexler even says that, and I quote that in the book. But at the end of the day, he also saved Atlantic Records thousands of dollars, in fees, and which increased their profits. And so then that story gets told in the press. It gets told in Billboard. That filters its way into article to things like in Rolling Stone or Melody Maker in England, and in Cream and other and magazines. Like, the South is this mystical place where people just sort of sit around and they got hay bales in their pieces of hay in their teeth, and they pick guitar and whatever, and they can just make these songs up. And that happens everywhere. But again, a lot of it just comes from this misconception of the South as this agrarian paradise and then quote unquote natural abilities of these musicians to make music.
Yeah. And I thought it was interesting how one part of this mystique, as you get at, is this quote unquote Muscle Shoals sound that kind of plays into that, right? You kind of get it into this sort of gritty quality and all these different aspects. So can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, how is this branded? How is this tying into placemaking? Some of the stereotypes that you were talking about just a second ago.
Yeah. So, the book started off as a dissertation, as many of these things do. And, when I started off, the dissertation had it. I'm into music analysis and music theory, and so I actually went heavy into looking at the songs and like trying to figure out, like, is there a Muscle Shoals sound? And that was a question I asked all the musicians, and I was like, well, what is it? And it kind of blinded me when I did some of the research. And then as the years ticked off after I'd graduated from UNC, I began to think more about, like, there is no such thing as a Muscle Shoals sound. There's no such thing as a Nashville sound. And it becomes this, it's a process. And again, as I mentioned in the book, that it's the process for the Memphis sound, the Nashville sound, and the Muscle Shoals sound are all really similar. It's basically these really talented, quote unquote, untrained musicians, which was code for they couldn't read music, and they just sort of sat down, heard stuff in their head, and just able to play it. But there are differences. So, Motown had that the four on the floor drum beat and auxiliary percussion, tambourine particularly, and things that recorded stacks. And in Muscle Shoals, they were a little more raw. You listen to some Otis Redding recordings, there are things out of tune. You listen to some of the Shoals recordings, there are things out of tune. Like, this would not, it would have never happened in Motown. It's like, sorry, the guitar's out of tune. Sorry that you missed, the vocalist missed that note. But it had that quote unquote feeling. And again, and I tied that back into, some of the farm subsidy, I'm blanking on the name, like the James Agee photographs, the mournful look. And so it just had this feeling, was really important. And so again, and then people like Wexler picked up on that, and they said, oh yeah, there's more soul in the South because these are untrained musicians. At the end of the day, yeah, I mean, there are recordings in Muscle Shoals sound different than the stuff in Memphis and then stuff in Motown, basically the holy trinity of R&B and soul music. So as I said, in Muscle Shoals, there were probably 13 to 15 musicians on each recording, which is a lot. Memphis, was a little bit less. They often didn't have backing vocalists. They might have one or two people, but the Shoals had a lot of like choruses. And then contrast that in Motown. In Motown, there'd be an oboe or, you know, a bassoon on a recording, and that never happened in either Muscle Shoals or Memphis.
And can you talk a little bit too about kind of the racialized aspect of this? Like, you kind of use Nina's idea of sonic blackness and Jennifer's idea of the sonic color on to kind of complicate the fact that these coded black musics also were underpinned with these white musicians. Can you kind of talk a little bit about that, that people might be surprised by?
So as their work has demonstrated, the history of this racialization of sound goes back long before Muscle Shoals, right? It goes back to Redondo's work. You know, this happened the moment the first African slaves stepped on this continent, and so there has been a long history of, oh, the singer is black, therefore the music must be black, and that's fiction, not that the singers weren't black, because they were, but what's fiction is that the audiences don't realize that most audiences only focus on the star singer, and it still happens to this day. My students are still enamored. They still can't believe that, you know, Ed Sheeran writes K-pop songs. They see a K-pop group, and they assume everybody in the production is from South Korea. Like, that's not true. I've one of my former students actually has a number one K-pop song in South Korea, and he's from New Jersey. So it's still going on to this day. These musicians, both in Memphis and particularly obviously Muscle Shoals, they grew up listening to people like Chuck Berry and James Brown, Bobby Blue Bland, Ray Charles, and they loved that music. And Norbert Putnam said to me, "We love this music. We hear this, like, this is what we want to do." It is part of this generation who was very much rebellious, and they play that, and then they have this ability to mimic sonic blackness. And then you attach a singer like Wilson Pickett, or then of course Aretha Franklin, and then the music is received as black. When I started looking at some of the archival sources, you know, there was, you know, and sources that were targeted towards black audiences. So Jet Ebony, they tell the story that it's the with itness, right? And then in articles like in Time and others, like, it's the otherness of blackness music. And so the backing musicians kind of get erased in some ways. And so people like, oh my, and you know, as the introduction talked about, people show up there. Rod Stewart, that's how I opened the book. He shows up. He's like, I want to work with the black musicians. Like, there are none. There's those white guys over there. And he was like, he was bummed. And David told me the session didn't go that well because Rod was hoping, he had this fantasy of working with black musicians, and they just weren't any, or there were very few.
Yeah, and there's another layer too, with that mystique, right? Like, with sort of the myth making of like indigenous folklore, right, and Muscle Shoals, and that kind of gets erased. Can you talk a little bit more about that as well? The Singing River myth.
Yeah. So when I did more digging into the Singing River myth, that provided me with a through line to the whole book, and that helped me sort of conclude the whole story. As now the Singing River myth has become a big part of the way the region has branded itself. When I was down in Muscle Shoals a couple of years ago doing research, you know, I spent weeks looking into this history of the Singing River myth. It shows up in roughly, you know, it's discovered, so to speak. I'm using air quotes. I know I'm on the radio. I'm using air quotes. No one can see that. So you know, it's first written down, you know, in the 1800s, and then it reappears right around the time that what becomes the Wilson Dam as a way to tell the story, to encourage people, and then it just sits dormant for a long time, and then even in the 80s when one of the local papers starts to talk about the history of the music scene in Muscle Shoals, they don't even mention the Singing River. It's only later on. And yeah, the Native American culture of the Shoals in regards to the music scene is totally erased. Although the Shoals itself, which is a region, both a city and a region, they very much celebrate the Native American culture, that heritage that's there, but is in regards to the music, it's kind of left out. You know, in the movie, they very much other it. You know, they show Tom's wall and they play the tribal music, the drum, you know, all these typical Hollywood tropes. You know, and the camera pans along this wall really fast, and like in this sort of like warlike, something, more air quotes, you know, warlike scene. And then they tie it all to it must be in the water, because it's an easy and it's a lazy way to describe the, as opposed to saying there were some really talented people down there. They say, oh, it must be the water, because why didn't it happen somewhere else? It's like, well, maybe because there was just a lot of talented people there. It's not the water. So.
Yeah. And it even reaches the statewide discourse, like at the Bicentennial Festival, they were totally recording and promoting that myth, even in Montgomery. So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know. And, you know. And you know. And you know. You know. I'm friends with Carolyn Crawford, who was a friend of mine, who was the director of the Heritage Area. You know, not long after I met her a couple years ago. She emailed me. She's like, oh, she's like, there's now a Singing River Trail, like 50 miles away in Huntsville. It has nothing to do with this. So it is this very wide embrace of this. I mean, obviously the river runs by Huntsville, but it has ballooned into this big thing, you know. And again, I interviewed Judy Sizemore in 2011. She was the first director of the Heritage Area. And, you know, she said to me point blank, and it's quoted in the book, she's like, oh, that myth, it's a great marketing tool. And I mean, and that's exactly what it's become.
Yeah. It's really fascinating. And, you know, you kind of talk about this a little bit in the book too, about how the areas has sort of pride itself on all these different types of exceptionalism, like in terms of we've had like better race relations than like the rest of the state and that kind of thing. And so there's all these different layers that build up to this mystique that you're talking about. And kind of getting more into the tourism side of all that, right? Like you started getting at this a little bit, but can you talk a little bit more about how there was, you know, for a while, a little bit of a struggle to get that tourism economy? Like what were some of the ups and downs and highs and lows, if you will, of kind of getting Shoals to be more well known, I guess?
Yeah. So, I get, you know, that chapter, I loved writing that chapter. It's what's now the last chapter. And I was working at the Alabama Music Hall of Fame and I found a box. They have a loft and there was a box. It said, MSMA Stuff, which is Muscle Shoals Music Association. And it was a cardboard box just full of like paperwork, unfiled. And I was like, oh, this is a gold mine. I go through it. And so I started telling the history of the Muscle Shoals Music Association, which was a very big, important force for a long time. And they're coming back as well. And then, you know, and, you know, tied to this exceptionalism concept is, you know, this organization, the Muscle Shoals Music Association, they have this music conference that seems to, as far as I can tell, is the first of its kind. And it's, again, that history is just completely gone. No one seems to know about that. We had these six multi-day conference, for six years, a multi-day conference, and it predates South by Southwest. I mean, Midham, which is the biggest in the world, like that's from the 60s, but it wasn't the same scale, but the first in this U.S. And so what happened as the music industry begins to shift, And so recording scenes like the Shoals, much like LA or New York, even Nashville, self-contained bands are not hiring session musicians. So the recording industry seems to decline a little bit. What happens is, you know, the Swampers themselves, they sell their studio. Barry Beckett moves to Nashville, and so there's just less recording going on in the Shoals, and that also coincides with kind of an economic downturn in the U.S. in general in the 80s. And so they don't know what to do. And the Shoals itself has to figure out, well, we've lost some big industry, you know, the things like the TVA is kind of sort of on a downcline, a decline, like, is that a word? It is now. So they decide that the Shoals decides, we're going to invest into our own cultural history. And the first thing they have is they have the river for fishing, which is this beautiful river. They have massive, you know, bass tournaments, and they have Helen Keller. And so that's what they invest in. And so the tourism people I interviewed said that was their focus because, and they're like, oh yeah, by the way, there's a studio over there. And that's where the Stones recording. People are like, oh my God, but the studios were private and they had always been private. And because it's a private industry, and, you know, and at that point, Muscle Shoals Sound was more or less out of business. although Malika was there, they weren't necessarily, there were no tours. And, you know, you have to be a music aficionado to know about these things. And then they decide that, oh, maybe the music is a big part of our heritage and we could use this as a selling point. And so it takes a very, very long time. And it's only recently, it's in the past 10 years or so that they've really embraced this. And the movie was like the wake up call for people, like, oh, wow, that was happening here. And yeah, it's, oh my God, it's 55 years old. Like, yeah. And, you know, and it's funny when I first went down to the Shoals in 2011, I'd meet some random people and like, oh, what are you doing here? I'm like, oh, I'm doing some research on the music industry. Like, oh, what's that? I was like, oh, you know, well, I don't know. How do you know this person? Oh yeah, I've heard of them. And then when I went back the last time in 2019, everyone was like, oh yeah, I knew all about this. Like, I doubt that. I doubt you knew anything about this because everyone, you know, as Judy Hood said to me, it's like everyone, they want to own it to a fault. Cause now it's like, oh, this was us. We knew all about this. When in fact, nobody did. And so it's, and that is tied with the Singing River stuff. There's a Singing River Bridge. There's Tom's Wall, which is a beautiful monument. And they start trying to figure this out, and then the Florence Lauderdale Tourism Center, they build a new center, and they start using music as one of their cultural pillars. And sort of some of this is tied to the fact that the Muscle Shoals National Heritage Area, one of the pillars is music, and so they decide to use that, and so there's now federal dollars coming in to support this, and then people have to figure out, okay, how are we going to sell this? How are we going to attract people to these places?
Yeah, I'm curious. More recently, have you seen how this area has responded to like the pandemic and stuff with that economy? Like, have they tried to do any virtual stuff? You know, what's been going on recently?
Well, I mean, I do follow a lot of these places on social media, and you know, it was Alabama, and they didn't completely shut down, and I'm sure. You know, yes, obviously things were closed for some months, but as far as I tell, they opened right back up again. You know, pretty quickly, and we're giving tours. I don't know the numbers. When I was last there in the summer of 2019, they were like Muscle Shoals Sound was doing like 3,000 people a month. And of course, obviously the numbers would go down. I don't know what the numbers are now, but yeah, they weren't necessarily doing virtual stuff. But they, as far as I tell, they never, other than maybe the first 4 or 5 months, they didn't stop. They never stopped. One of the things too is that, you know, both Muscle Shoals Sound and Fame in particular, it's a working studio. So Chris Stapleton recorded some of his most recent record at Sound, and you anybody can actually record there. You have to give them enough notice, and you have to pay their fees. So I would suspect that they probably did some recording when during the pandemic, because all right, you know, as long as you don't need to have tourists coming through, you know, like as long as everyone's distance enough. So I'm not exactly sure how they handled the pandemic, but as far as I can tell, they're back up and running. You know, Fame is giving tours. Sound gives tours. It's relatively inexpensive. I mean, they're not very big places. I mean, Muscle Shoals Sound is actually surprisingly small. So I think, you know, it's like, I'm looking at my house. It's like, it's not much bigger than the ground floor of my house. And the same with Fame, but there's a lot of history there.
Fascinating. And speaking of that history, you know, you kind of started talking about earlier about one thing that might strike people with the book is the role of country in the area, right? Can you kind of get, and you know, this book brings so many of these key players, you know, to this front center. Can you talk a little bit about some of the different like genres that each generation of studio musicians recorded, you know, leading up to kind of the more recent things that we're talking about? Like, how did the one generation of studio musicians shape the next, I guess?
So it's an interesting question. You know, the Shoals becomes an R&B scene by happenstance. Arthur Alexander records You Better Move On, and it becomes a regional hit and a national. It gets to number 24 in Billboard. Had it been a white country musician, it would have been a country scene. And so that paves the way for about 10 years where Rick Hall, his session musicians, all work in the R&B industry. But studio musicians have the ability to just play whatever. As Jimmy Johnson said, we call ourselves chameleons. We could, you come in, you want a country song, we could do that. As the national music scene pivots away from R&B into country and pop music, that's where they go. And you know, for a long portion of that history, you know, especially the most social sound guys, it's the same four guys who are recording. They start off recording Wilson Pickett in the mid 60s. And then, you know, 10 years later, they're working with the Oak Ridge Boys. And so in like, which most people would see as night and day, but the musician's like, it's just a different day. It's there's only 12 notes to choose from. It's just a slightly different, I'm going to adjust the timbre of my guitar. And so they have the music scene, any music scene needs to be able to pivot, because pop music shifts so fast. If you're only doing one thing, then at some point the mainstream music is going to go by you. And the move to country music started primarily at Music Mill, with this one, the one studio owner was like, all right, there's really very few studios in the area doing country music. I'm going to bring in some country music. I'm going to bring some country artists, and I'm going to put some soulful pop musicians behind them, and let's see what happens. And it explodes. And you know, and primarily it's, you know, what sustains the Shoals through that country period in the late 70s into the 80s, it's not the recording industry, it's actually the songwriters. And, you know, Rodney Hall, you know, said to me, you know, in an email, he's like, I'm really glad you talked about publishing, because, you know, the studio rental, you come in and the studio, they, you know, you can rent the studio, maybe it's $1,000 a day, and that's great. But like, you get a hit song, and they're making money for the rest of their lives. I mean, you look at the John Michael Montgomery song, you know, I Swear, which is both a number one hit at R&B and pop and country at the same time, 20 million copies of that song. I mean, that's still paying the rent at from one song. And they have dozens of songs, not to that same level, but they have lots of them. So country music, you know, people like Walt Aldridge and others, Robert Byrne, they start writing these hits for these various groups. And that paves the way for fame for probably a decade, and even longer, even into the year 2000. You know, Every Time He Cheats, the Carrie Underwood song. I mean, that was co-written by Muscle Shoals, by a famed songwriter. So, you know, Brad Chisler, there's all these guys are still working in the Shoals that still attached to the public to Nashville. And again, because country isn't cool, so that story's left out of the documentary. And also I think primarily because a lot of the session musicians weren't involved in those recordings. So it wasn't as sexy to talk about that, but it's all there, you know, and you know, Barry Beckett, you know, goes to Nashville and becomes the number one producer for several years, you know, and, he helps discover, and Kenny Chesney is, you know, basically, you know, comes out of his, you know, Barry Beckett didn't discover Kenny Chesney, but Chesney worked with Beckett for his first three or four records.
Yeah. And so you were talking about how, you know, you have all these different people that you've brought to the forefront here. And I was curious, in your research process, was there anything else that surprised you? Because it sounds like you went digging several different places. Like, you know, were there any like, holy crap, I did not expect this. Like, what were some of the gems of your research, I guess?
Well, some of the gems, again, you know, when I did the stuff about the Muscle Shoals Music Association, when I looked into their conference, you know, their fish fries that they call them, and, you know, and realized that this was going on. And then, when I was digging into, when I started working on the country music chapter, which I wrote very quickly, only took about 5 weeks to write that chapter. I would sit here and do my research, and I would come home. I was home, and I'd come to dinner to sit with my wife and be like, I can't believe that Walt Aldridge wrote this song as well. It was staggering. Like, I knew that song. I mean, my advisor at Chapel Hill, Jocelyn Neal, you know, is like one of the, you know, country music scholar. And, you know, it's just like, oh my God, that song too. And I know that song. And, it was just stupefying how much music that passed through the Shoals in some way or another. That is, again, people don't necessarily read the credits. So that was one of the things that was just like, wow. I was someone who was about as well versed in this as anybody else on the planet. I was like, holy cow, I can't believe that song as well. And also, one of the things too that, you know, I need to credit a friend of mine in the Shoals, this guy Tony Lee, had said to me, you know, he was like, you should look into, you know, the 50s stuff, because it's not all Rick Holland. And I knew that. And, you know, one of the things that I laid out in the beginning of the book is like, there was a pretty significant base there to begin with that allowed Rick Hall to step higher. You know, again, it's kind of like the standing on the shoulders of giants. Not that these guys were giants in the 50s, but Rick Hall didn't just come in and invent this thing from scratch. He was able to capitalize. And again, he deserves significant credit. You know, he built it to a high level and sustained it. But they were, you know, but that story too, I was very happy to tell that story because that story is just left. No one seems to know that story. And again, it was all there. It was all in the folders at the various archives. It just no one bothered to tell it.
Yeah. And I know I've been kind of guiding the conversation here for quite a while. So I wanted to open it up to you. Is there anything else about this research and about this book that you want to share with our listeners that we haven't already touched on?
Well, you know, I guess the only thing, I mean, you know, we've touched on a lot of it, and I appreciate the opportunity. You know, I'm going to be very clear, like, this is one way to tell the story, you know, so it is, I'm sure there's going to be some people who are going to be upset by what I say, and some people are going to be surprised, and people are going to be mad they were left out, or how come that person got more ink than they did. But it's history, right? There's only so much space I can tell. There's only so much space I have. And, you know, but I, you know, when I shared some of the book with Rodney Hall, Rick's son, and he wrote back, he's like, wow, there's a bunch of stuff I didn't even know about. And it's like, of course, why would you have known? Like, you know, you're not a historian, but like you're the one living this. Why would you have known? Like, it makes perfect sense. You would not know this, you know? I don't think I have anything else that I need to add. Cause I mean, it's just like, I probably have enough research for another book too. Although that's not happening. Cause it's like, yeah, but.
Cool. And speaking of other books, what other projects are you working now in general?
Besides my gig as a teacher, I'm also a musician. I play, I'm a songwriter. I usually play a gig about once a month where I live in the Hudson Valley. And I'm going to start doing some work with a friend of mine in Australia. We're going to start doing some more music industry related stuff. Going to do some stuff about touring. I'll start off with, we're actually meeting in a couple nights to sort of hash out ideas for an article and which will probably maybe become a book, because there's not many sources on touring, and I have a significant background on touring, and as a she. So that's kind of, I mean, basically I've been taking the summer off. So, you know, it's, you know, it took me 10 years to work. And well, depending on when you start, depending on when I started this thing, it's like, it was either 2009, you know, or when I was 13. So, you know, it's been a long time finishing this thing. Oh, I mean, the book has been done for well over a year. It just takes time for the press to get stuff together. So I'm just kind of chilling at the moment as far as research. I'm thinking, how about that?
I like it. I like it. Sounds like a great plan. And I'll look forward to, you know, reading more about your touring stuff eventually. And it was a pleasure to read the book and to talk with you about it. So thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, Emily, thank you. So I very much appreciate the opportunity to be on the program. Thank you so much.
No problem. And listeners, giving you a quick recap, this was a talk with Christopher Reale, author of Music and Mystique in Muscle Shoals, published by Illinois Press in 2022. This is Emily Allen, and I'll catch you next time here on the New Books Network.